to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have with me today Lamont Wood, who's the author of Out of Place in Time and Space, Inventions, Beliefs, and Artistic Anomalies That Were Impossibly Ahead of Their Time.
Yes.
Hi, Lamont. How are you doing?
I'm glad to be here.
I guess I can introduce you as a journalist and freelance writer.
Mm-hmm.
And would you mind telling our audience what struck you to write such a book?
Well, I was always a history buff, and it's been long, basically, since, you know, probably high school. I made mental notes of these odd historical oddities I came across that seemed to fly in the face of a strictly linear conception of time.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I started writing it down, and the eventual result is the book you see here. I have, I think, 40 different examples in there. You'd think I would know the exact number. Of basically historical oddities that, like I say, fly in the face of the linear conception of time, things that just don't seem to be in the right place time-wise. When doing this, I was looking for a sort of a high concept that it would all fit into, and came up with the idea of that I call the reverse anachronism. Now, a standard anachronism, a conventional one, is where you go to the movies, and like the movies about Rome, for instance. And but the actors are speaking English, and so they're having something depicted there 2,000 years out of date. But you accept that because you don't know Latin. If they spoke Latin, that would be a problem. So that's conventional anachronism. Reverse anachronism is when you look into the past and see something there that appears to belong to the present, and if those things are happen. Logic would demand that there are historical anachronisms in the future, here in the present, that we probably are incapable of recognizing for what they are. We see them as noise, or that we misunderstand them. Now, an example of what I'm talking about would be the Antikythera mechanism, a device found on the seabed off the Greek island of Antikythera, hence the name, in 1901. And originally they thought it was a corroded jumble of gears. They didn't know what it was. Nowadays, it has sort of come into sync with the present, and we can recognize it for what it was. It was an ancient Roman computer, not in the sense it was a digital device that you could program, but a computer in the old sense where the programming is built into the design with the gearing, etc. In this case, it was a machine mostly used to reconcile the solar calendar with the lunar calendar, something we still do nowadays when we figure out the date for Easter based on the lunar calendar, and then tell you the date for Easter, April so-and-so, based on the solar calendar. So we still do that. This, again, would be an example of what I was talking about. When it was originally found, it was a reverse anachronism from the future, of the second kind. Now that we figure out what it is, it's like a reverse anachronism from the first kind, something from the present that shows up in the past. Now, usually it's information rather than objects. And in many cases, I look for some kind of rationalist explanation and can usually point to something, but not always. I try to stick to Occam's razor, the policy that an explanation that requires the fewest assumptions is the one to bet on. Now, admittedly, Occam's razor doesn't always lead you to the correct assumption. Sometimes it leads you in circles. But all things being equal, it's usually the one to bet on. But I have found examples in here that that's no help at all. I can't find any rational explanation. The most compelling one that I can't explain would probably be the one concerning the Apollo program being pretty much described in 1865, 100 years before it happened. Jules Verne is, of course, still famous as a science fiction author, and he wrote about 50 novels, and actually most of them were not science fiction. Most of them were action-adventure. But his very first one, written in 1865, was definitely science fiction, and it portrays an American effort to send three men to the moon in an aluminum capsule. They're launched from Florida, they circle the moon, they return to the Earth, they land in the Pacific Ocean, and are picked up by the U.S. Navy. Now, some of that may sound familiar.
Yeah.
that's a pretty good outline of the Apollo program, especially the Apollo 8 mission. And, of course, he didn't get it accurate. You know, he wasn't totally accurate. He did no mention of electronics, which, of course, are all important. Mm-hmm. And in his book, they use a cannon rather than a rocket, which wouldn't have worked. It would have killed the astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
But the rocket, it would have been, however, it was probably believable to readers in 1865, and he could, you know, I always set no details that they could relate to. But there's also things that you can't explain that way, because... of course, engineers can think in parallel lines, you know, centuries apart. So he knew orbital dynamics and knew that, you know, if you need to take off someplace far south, close to the equator, it'll take about 4 days to get to the moon if you get get to escape velocity, et cetera, et cetera. But there's things in there that don't come from celestial mechanics.
It's almost as if he saw it but couldn't understand everything. Like, you've heard of Nostradamus, I'm sure.
Oh yes, yes.
And in one of his quatrains, he says that he sees flying pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Nostradamus was of course a physician, not a military person, but a friend of mine who studied Nostradamus was also a fighter pilot.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the U.S. Air. In fact, I was in San Antonio for 5 years.
Randolph
Hall. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he said, he called me up one day and he said, "I can't believe this. They've just issued us helmets, oxygen masks that make us look just like pigs."
Yep.
So, you know, it could be that Jules Verne was seeing something, just watching something. He had that ability, as Nostradamus did. I think Nostradamus looked into water in a basin, wasn't that right?
There's some mention of that.
Right, so some way, probably Nostradamus and Jules Verne were able to see things, but not necessarily interpret them. I mean, if you saw the Apollo being shot off, you wouldn't understand much of anything, but it kind of looked like a cannon, you know?
Yeah, right, especially after launch.
So
right.
Probably there's some way to see the future, and some people like Jules Verne were particularly adept at it, you know?
Well, yeah. Based on what research I've been able to do, it occurs to me that time is not really understood. We're in a position of like fish in the ocean who don't know what water is. I mean, we exist in time. We use time, but we don't really understand it. And a lot of, like, physical phenomena, the equations work the same, forward in time and backwards in time. Only biochemistry doesn't work backwards.
Mm-hmm.
We can't take time and, like, isolate it in the lab and do experiments with it. And sticking to, again, Occam's razor, to me the simplest explanation for that would be that time does not actually exist. There is no such thing. What we perceive as time.
I don't think time exists apart from other things. I think it's part of something called the time-space continuum.
Yeah.
You can't dissect time out.
Yeah. I personally believe it's a product of our perceptual mechanism, that there is only the huge present, and we're kind of nosing around in it. Of course, that's not very useful information, is it? What do we do with that? But it does imply that... you might be able to get information from some other series of events, basically. And you probably wouldn't know what it was. It's just noise, basically. But maybe it had some entertainment value, especially for someone like Jules Verne. And, you know, maybe these people out there in the street corner talking to themselves because of the breakdown of our mental health system, maybe they're picking up on stray things like that. You know what I mean? Not very helpful. If I'm right... physical time travel is not really possible, but we could pick up information from other streams of events. But, again, what do you do with it, you know? How do you know the provenance of it? How would it be useful? So,
there's an interesting factual example of something that may have occurred in Marie Antoinette's court. Have you read about that one?
Oh, the English tourists who think they wandered into her palace outbuildings or something.
Right.
Or something. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I mean, the way, and they're actually, that's one of a series of the also called time travel reports. But what I sort of see is that there are anomalies in space-time. Probably the best example would be the Bermuda Triangle, where there are very, very intense electromagnetic fields being produced by whatever. And if you happen to wander into one of those, you can find yourself displaced in time and or space. And that's pretty scientifically based, too, because very large electromagnetic fields evidently are able to displace people in time and space, according to, you know, things like the Philadelphia experience, experiment and the Montauk Project. So, you know, it could be that when people inadvertently wander into certain areas, they can be transported. Did you ever hear about the one about there was a guard guarding the ruler of the Philippines during an event where the Philippine ruler was overthrown?
No,
and he ended up in Mexico?
No, I haven't heard that one. But go ahead.
Well, it's interesting. This occurred in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
So he was guarding the Philippine king. And there was some sort of revolution. And he tried to defend the king, but ended up in Mexico. And they arrested him in Mexico because he just sort of, he didn't have a good explanation why he was there, and they thought he was up to no good. And he was actually put in a Mexican jail. And I think it took 5 months for the news to get from the Philippines to Mexico that there had been a revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And then they let him out because they realized that the story he was telling was true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's documented, so you might want to look into that one.
Yeah. Well,
very
interesting. If time is an illusion, very likely, you know, space objects are also illusions, you know. So,
well, the space-time continuum is related.
Yeah.
We know that from physics. So if both, I mean, I would say both time and space are constructs rather than something that, you know, in other words, they're constructs, like you mentioned, of our perceptual awareness.
Yeah.
So, but they are related to each other. I mean, you know, you study physics, they obviously are related to each other. So when you have, and if you look at all these time travel stories, number one, the people doing the time traveling aren't trying to do the time travel. And a lot of times their lives are in significant danger when the time travel takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is some sort of a wormhole or something that isn't supposed to be there that somehow they fall into and then get somewhere else, either in time or space or whatever, what we can say is that maybe the construct of time-space isn't exactly solid. You know, there are little cracks in it.
Right, right. Well, my book, like I say, may show some cracks.
there you go.
Yeah. Like I say, some of them I can kind of explain away, and you're welcome to reject the explanations, because some of them are a little lame, but there often is some kind of explanation, but some of them, I just have to, you know, leave it out there. I really don't know. But everything is actually, you know, research based on, you know, real events, as far as I can tell, actual research. My other favorite mystery, and I can't really, well, it's such a mystery, it's hard to even even come up with any explanation, would be the so-called Voynich manuscript.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and then people, you know, I'm talking about, you know, the possibility of reverse anachronisms in the future, and then people, of course, say, do you have a candidate for it? Well, maybe this is it, because this is an example of something that we can't relate to. It is totally alien to us. We have no way of even approaching the thing. It's a hand-lettered, hand-illustrated codex, a hand-bound book. That's been dated to 1420. It's written in an alphabetical language whose rules we can identify, and we can do a mathematical analysis on it and show that it is not word salad. It is an actual language. Trouble is, the alphabet exists nowhere else. The rules we can identify are of no known language. The mathematical properties of it don't match any language either. Yet it's written out and by someone who appears to know the language and is must have been fluent in it. And then there's the illustrations in it, which appear to be about things until you look at them carefully, and then you realize they're not really about anything. There's like botanical diagrams that don't really match any known plants, and what appear to be astronomical diagrams that don't match anything from astronomy, mm-hmm. and just a lot of weird things like Dr. Seuss plumbing, basically, and a lot of pictures of naked women in unerotic poses, and the things are very difficult to explain, really. It's either, if it's a hoax, someone went to enormous effort put in features in it that would probably, you know, impress the CIA, but I don't think that was an issue in 1420.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be an expression of someone with what's called OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Such people have been known to invent languages and you know, our whole world, in fact, and write books in it. But the person who did this had access to the tools and material and the time to do this in 1420, and that was those have been uncommon traits to have mm-hmm. those tools and that skill. Of course, it would only take one person, but still, it seems unlikely. Or, like I say, it's a reverse anachronism from the future. Maybe in 500 years we'll be able to figure it out. Maybe we'll, at some point something will come along to make it all clear. But at this point, we have no way to even approach it. It's just noise, really. And so that fits my theory. If we're going to have reverse anachronisms in the future, they would just be mystifying to us, really. Of course, my favorite example in the book is the one I lead off with in Chapter 1, the so-called Virgin Child of Toy Helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a religious painting that's been hanging in a museum in France probably for centuries, but only in the last few decades have we paid much attention to one little detail. The Christ Child is sitting in the lap of the Madonna, as you would expect. But the Christ Child appears to be playing with a pull-string flying toy helicopter, which is really odd, since it was known to have been painted in about 1460. People keep saying, well, Leonardo da Vinci sketched a helicopter. Yeah, he was 8 years old when this was made.
Mm-hmm.
There we are, a little toy flying machine in a painting in the Middle Ages. Presumably, the artist put it there because it allowed him to introduce a crucifix theme, with four blades on a little helicopter. He needed to put a toy in the hands of the Christ Child to show that this is a child, because of the artistic conventions at the time just showed children as scale model adults.
Mm-hmm.
But it implies that the artist assumed that he would not be confusing his audience, that they would look at it and know what it was. So such things must have been in some circulation at that time, which is mystifying because the history of aeronautical development and flying, actual flying machines by serious scholars, you don't go with helicopters, they don't go back earlier than about 1784, I think, and didn't have any success in 1906. Like, say, here's a toy from 1460 doing that. Again, sort of a reverse anachronism from the present. So we look back and there it is. And, of course, at the time, it was, you know, just a toy. People didn't really see it beyond that. And that's another theme I came across researching the book, is that toys may, in fact, embody high technology in a given culture, but people pay no attention to them. I discovered that the Greeks and Romans had steam-powered toys, for instance, and apparently never considered using them for serious work. They were just, you know, frivolous toys. And we've all heard tales of the toys they found in Central American tombs, which had wheels on them, yet
mm-hmm.
Those cultures did not use wheeled transportation. Although presumably that's because they didn't have decent roads and draft animals and the metal for, you know, axles and hubs and stuff. But it's still an ongoing theme. It really gets your attention. You have to wonder, what are the kids playing with nowadays? You know, do we really understand tops? bicycles. You know, bicycles are rather complicated. You realize that there's all that gyroscopic action going on. You know, and the kids are running around using them as a, like there's nothing to it. So, you know, it does open your eyes.
It does. It's interesting. Makes you wonder what, why we're able to find these things too. The things that are put in tombs are very interesting.
Yeah, that's true. Again, the book is called Out of Place in Time and Space. It is available through Amazon or in better bookstores. It's about there are 40 standalone chapters. You can just pick it up and read it in the, on an airplane or something. It's written for entertainment value. I've gotten a lot of comments on the humor I used. Frankly, I don't remember.
Right.
Humor, but I think I must have used enough to entertain somebody somewhere. So,
do you have a website you'd like to mention?
No. Just look for it on Amazon. Just call up the name there. Like I say, Out of Place in Time and Space.
Well, great. Some of the things that got my attention were the war machines that were out of time.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that is, you think that would get more attention actually? But most of it is from the siege of Syracuse in 212 BC. There were three ancient Greek and Roman historians who gave like first-hand accounts or accounts obviously based on eyewitness accounts of what happened. And it sounds like science fiction. It's been sitting on the bookshelves for, you know, 20 centuries, and people just nod and go on. But when you read it, it reads like War of the Worlds or something.
Mm-hmm.
Let me explain that the city-state of Syracuse in eastern Sicily was a Roman ally during the Second Punic War. That is the war where Hannibal was running wild with elephants and defeating all these Roman armies. But there was a coup d'etat there, and they went over to the enemy camp, the Carthaginian camp. And so Rome sent an army to retake the place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't seem to have taken into account the fact that the ruler of Syracuse, the one who was heirs were overthrown by the coup d'etat, had put defense planning for the city into the hands of a relative named Archimedes. Now, this is the same Archimedes we associate with the Archimedes screw, and the guy who figured out the relationship between volume and weight and stuff, and the guy who established the mathematical description of the lever, et cetera, et cetera. So they attacked the city walls in daytime and discovered that they were like being tracked by missile fire, catapult fire, indirectly over the walls as they moved around, even following them even to the base of the walls, which I thought was impossible. Now, that implies very finely made catapults, accurate rangefinders, and central fire control. You don't see that combination until the 20th century with modern artillery, but here they were doing it. Now, so they came back for night attack, and they brought their ships up against the seawall where the water was deep enough, and they were going to put ladders over the seawall and storm the place. And as they approached it, though, they described these large machines rearing up on the other side of the wall, and extending booms out over the water, from which they either drop heavy weights onto the ships and sank them, or drop grappling hooks that they used to capsize them. Now, presumably, he had built something that, or a whole bunch of them, things that resembled modern construction cranes, where you have the upright pillar and then the horizontal arm. And he didn't have diesel engines to run them, but presumably he had some kind of a pre-positioned drop weights to power them. Some kind of Rube Goldberg kind of thing. And again, the Romans panicked and fled. And they ended up laying siege to the city. Roman historians said that any time they saw like a stick or a rope sticking over the walls, they'd panic and run away to figure some machine was about to appear. And the city eventually fell to siege, and there was the usual looting and brutality and stuff, and Archimedes was killed by one of the looters. And we don't hear any further mention of these machines. They fell into Roman hands, but the Romans apparently had no use for them, probably using them for kindling or something. I think it was probably way over their heads. But anyway, like I say, it's been sitting there in these history books on the shelves for centuries, and it probably only now do we read them and say, oh, yeah, we understand that. But previously, they figured, oh, this is like a harbor crane you put, that they placed on the walls, which, however, doesn't match the description of what happened by the actual survivors. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, we have the description of the death rays that Archimedes used. Now, when we talk about that, I have to caution you that those first-hand historians I mentioned earlier, they don't mention it. The accounts of the death rays come from later Byzantine or medieval accounts, and they make it pretty clear that he had probably like billboard-sized arrays of polished metal mirrors that he used to reflect sunlight onto the enemy ships and set them on fire. Now, modern efforts to reconstruct that and replicate that have had mixed results. You just can't get the ships to like burst into flames. You can do some charring, but maybe
they had different things on the ship then.
That's true. But I also point out that setting the ship on fire may have been secondary. I was relaxing one evening watching one of these celebrity news programs, all the softball news about this and that celebrity. And they were talking about Jennifer Aniston having a birthday party at a resort on the southern tip of Baja California, in a Mexican resort. And she's out there on the beach, and there's all these paparazzi boats just beyond the surf bobbing out there. Mm-hmm. So the hotel manager gets people lined up on the beach, each holding a large mirror and reflecting sunlight in the faces of the paparazzi, and just basically drives them away. So I'm thinking, well, maybe Archimedes is trying to do something like that, just trying to neutralize the Roman pickup boats so that his ships could get, you know, his blockade runners could get in and out of the harbor, could give them a head start. Better to do that in daytime than at night, you know, a lot safer. And if you set an enemy ship on fire, you know, so much better. So, maybe he did do all that, but he had other, you know, goals in mind, more limited goals. But beyond that, you know, now I'm aware that there are people out there who are convinced the ancients had electricity and stuff like that. And I don't see any evidence of that here. I don't see that they actually did manage to make a laser beam or something like that. That requires a lot of assumptions. But we are talking about Archimedes here. and he's full of surprises, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I think what Archimedes was, his talents would include angles and, you know, mirrors and things like that, too.
Right, right. He left a pretty large volume of writings, and none of them actually are about war machines. Mm-hmm. Probably that was, you know, a military secret. He wasn't going to describe that. Yeah. But he does describe things like how to establish the volume of a curved shape. Well, a ship's hull is a curved shape, and if you know the volume, you even determine how much it weighs, and therefore establish how much force you would need to capsize and remove it, etc.
Mm-hmm.
He also describes, he also wrote about parabolas and parabolic mirrors. Well, that would be perfect for these mirrors, mm-hmm. these death ray things, parabolic mirrors. So it all fits together. I mean,
what drives people to invent things is usually necessity and also funding. I mean, the funding, look at us funding the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is well-funded where, you know, he was probably well-funded from the city-state that...
It was a rich city-state.
Yeah,
so
right.
Apparently
right.
had all the money he could ask for.
And, you know, it's interesting, in the same light, you could read some of the things published in scientific peer-reviewed journals that come out of the Navy and other think tanks for the military,
mm-hmm.
and you can sort of see the direction that things are going, you know.
Right. Absolutely, yeah, right.
And again, they don't mention war either. But
right, and they don't get the specifics, but, you know, they're talking about rail guns, and you realize, they must be trying to get away from conventional artillery here, et cetera, et cetera. So, things like that do happen, definitely. And like
follow
said,
the money.
He was
you're a journalist, you know that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, I point out elsewhere, Archimedes, he gets three chapters in the book because they also recently were able to reconstruct his last surviving manuscript. When I say manuscript, it's actually a medieval copy of a Greek copy of probably
that's
his
amazing
original manuscript.
That survived.
Yeah. Yeah, well, actually it didn't survive. It's what they call a palimpsest. Someone a few hundred years after it was copied down, unbound it and erased it and used it as a prayer book. But with modern technology, you can bring out the original material.
Okay.
And in the last few years, they were able to do this and realized that he is talking about what we would now call calculus and number theory.
Mm-hmm.
Calculus, usually they consider it Isaac Newton invented it about 1700. And number theory goes back to about 1890 or so. And here he is solving equations or problems using what appears to be references to an understanding of calculus and number theory, or at least some of the bases of calculus and number theory, in 2200 B.C. So, yeah, the man is genuinely a genius.
Very smart guy.
Yeah, no getting around it. Genius isn't enough, I've discovered.
No, not from what you described happened in Spartacus.
No, and I ran across a number of examples of people who were fairly good at predicting the future and more or less built their careers around it, and it didn't really help. You think that would be a surefire way to boost one's career, but no, not really. The worst
the guy
example,
was the
of course,
Titanic?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And as a writer, you know, I have to feel for him. But we're talking about W.T. Stead. He was a Victorian journalist. He was in on the founding of the tabloid genre. And here, after recent closing of the News of the World, we may be in on the death of the tabloid genre. But he was, you know, sensationalist journalism, usually for an afternoon paper. The morning papers have the news, and the afternoon paper
right.
has the sensationalism stuff. And he was into that, and he was not above pursuing causes and making up stories, in fact. Well, he would give it away toward the end, you know, this is a sensationalized account of what might happen if we don't get some reforms going.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the causes he did pick up were the Admiralty laws that did not require there to be enough lifeboats, passenger ship, for everyone. They had these arcane calculations about how many lifeboats you needed, based on, I assume, the size of the vessel rather than the number of passengers.
you would think, huh?
Yeah. And they weren't totally insane because back then they used a lot more smaller ships. And if you stayed to the in the shipping lanes, there was usually ships around. So you could usually count on rescue, and at least in clear weather, if there was any hope of rescue. But anyway, so he got rich, basically. And doing all these things and founded his own magazine and pursued these causes, et cetera. And at one point decided to attend a conference in the U.S. And having gotten rich, he, of course, got the best available accommodations, which turned out to be a first-class ticket on the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to wonder what he was thinking as he got aboard. You know, did he count those lifeboats? Did he? Because he had written about it. He had not only written about it, he had written a story at one point describing what would happen if there was a mid-ocean collision and the passenger liner proceeded to sink and there were not enough lifeboats, and the panic that would break out and the mass loss of life and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote another, in fact, a novel one time based on what would happen if a ship hit an iceberg. These are two separate pieces of fiction he wrote. And they all come together in real life there in 1912, and there he is on the deck of the Titanic while he's going down, and you have to wonder what, you know, what was going through his mind. We don't know. He didn't survive. He was one of the fatalities. There is one survivor said that he was the one who went to the band and suggested they play Near My God to Thee or something like that, and which may be his final message to us. I don't know. But, like I say, seeing the future is not always helpful. And then of course there's Douglas C. Engelbart, who he's still around, in fact. He was driving to work in the early 50s when he had this vision of himself sitting in front of an interactive computer display.
Mm-hmm.
And he could control what was on the screen, and he was navigating through a landscape not of physical objects or geography, but of ideas and concepts. Mm-hmm. And if you're sitting at your computer with these icons and mouse, that's what you're doing. You're moving.
Right.
You're navigating this landscape of concepts, basically. And he set about, he devoted his career to making this happen. And he had what's called the mother of all demos in 1967, which first public use of a mouse and a graphical display and an email and various and video conferencing also, and various other things that now you can get at Best Buy. But like I say, this first brought it all together and with great difficulty in 1967. And of course, most people had never heard of him. After that, you know, he became a consultant for mainframe companies, and no one was particularly interested in all this. So, again, seeing the future is not always
profitable.
Yeah, not always profitable. It's amazing. Of course, there's the. Also, talk about the French cartoonist Albert Robida, who wrote an illustrated novel in the 1880s describing the 20th century. That was, in fact, the name of it, the 20th century. And it describes, you know, air travel and instant communications and everyone, people existing basically in an environment of instant communication, just being barraged by news from all over the world constantly and being in touch with each other, their phones everywhere, their flat video conferencing screens that you can use to dial other conferencing screens. I mean, it's the internet in all but name, basically. And when you look at it, you wonder, it's supposed to be set in 2050, and you think, well, he was off by about 50 years. It should have been in the year 2000, basically. He lived on to see the 20th century. He had predicted there would be a catastrophic war in 1910. He was off by 4 years, and a number of his family members were killed or maimed in the war, and he died a bitter old man in 1920 saying how much he hated the 20th century, and et cetera, et cetera. It was, like I say, no benefit to him.
Well, that makes sense, though, if you're seeing, I don't know, I think if you're seeing the entire, he was different, and he was seeing the entire world.
Right.
You see what I mean? The big picture.
Right, that's a very big picture, actually, yes.
Right.
And he didn't get it all right. I mean, he didn't predict radio or antibiotics, which his people could have used, frankly, his character. But he gets a lot of surprising number of things right.
He's an observer with a certain degree of education, and mm-hmm. you know, I mean, if I was observing, you know, computers from my understanding as a, mm-hmm. you know, in elementary school in the 60s,
yeah.
I wouldn't know anything about them. I mean, you have to have the files to understand everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you really do, to make it useful, especially with high technology. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The fact somebody gets a shot or a pill and infection disappears, if you see that, say it's a visual thing, you're not going to understand what happened.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
But even beyond that, you know, you mentioned computers. I've been covering the high-tech industry since the early 80s, and I don't think in the early 80s I would have predicted what we have nowadays. That I can sit here at a desk and do video conferencing and have this graphical display and have this enormous power at my fingertips and have printers that basically you can have output as good as the newspapers I was working for in the 80s.
Right.
Some of them just slower, basically. The resolution is actually superior. And I can sit here and, you know, print out nicely formatted books if I want to. I wouldn't have predicted all that, and I continue to write articles about what the near future is going to be about, and we have not plateaued. Things are continuing to roll ahead. I was writing recently about what they call the Internet of Things. In the foreseeable future, almost anything with an on-off switch will have some built-in intelligence, and probably some. Internet connection, so you can query it from a distance,
mm-hmm.
and presumably you could like drive through town and query all the buildings and businesses that as you go by and see what's up, you know, and mm-hmm. see what you need to do and where you need to go and find out what the city could tell you what traffic is like. And, And they're talking about theme parks where you would, it's all mostly virtual. You get glasses and, you know, that pick up the graphics and walk in and interact with other people, I guess, and something different, colorful monsters or something. I don't know what they'd be, but. But anyway, the sky's the limit. I mean, we have not really even scratched the surface in terms of what computers can do.
Well, let me ask you a question. This is something that it seems to be going in two different directions, and they're going away from each other. One is, you know, the kid that does nothing but play video games and, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't have any interpersonal interaction with anybody mm-hmm. Except through the computer mm-hmm. and is more and more and more isolated. Mm-hmm. And then the other direction, which is the Facebook and the social media
mm-hmm.
that
right.
might even be propelling, you know, overthrows of governments potentially.
Yeah, that might be.
I mean,
yeah.
those are the two interesting things that I see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're creating, on one hand, kids that can't interact at all because they never do, you know, with people.
Right, right. I think with computers, you can reinforce existing behavior. I don't think you can pretty much create new behavior, but you can certainly reinforce existing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to be socially isolated, you can do that. However, there is also the potential there to reach out if you want to do so at any moment, as you point out.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you're doing anything new here. And in fact, it may be giving people more potential than I assume it is, giving people a lot more potential than they previously had. Yes, you can play video games on it, but you can also go online and look up just about any topic you want to and get just about any question you want answered. And if you want to be social, you can flip over to Facebook or one of the others and do that, too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
But what if people never get together, you know? Girl Scouts, I mean, you and I had Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts,
mm-hmm.
you know, all mm-hmm. sorts of stuff at school.
Right.
You know, the journalist club, which the question is, do they still do those things in high school?
Last I checked, a lot of the stuff had gone away because of
like debating club. I mean,
yeah,
is that even
yeah.
there?
I wonder myself.
Yeah.
And it is scary. We need if we're going to have this reinforcement. We need, you know, physical reinforcement too. We need the real world also out there. It should beckon them too.
Well, interacting with people in a group of kids that get together after school with a common interest and then
mm-hmm.
want to do something like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a debate, or maybe mm-hmm. put on a car wash to earn money for a charity or something,
mm-hmm.
is very different than just interacting with people on Facebook. I mean,
right.
very
mm-hmm.
different.
Mm-hmm.
Different skill sets.
You can develop leadership and all this stuff. You know?
Exactly.
And Facebook is cheaper, basically.
And, yeah.
and that is what bothers me. It is simply easier to do this. And both for the powers that be, you know, just depend on people being online and doing things, and for the individuals themselves. Now, again, as a result, people who do exert themselves can be like the Arab Spring, you know, and the revolutions in Egypt, et cetera.
Mm.
So it's I don't think we can make any really broad statements about it. Again, it reinforces pre-existing behavior. I think we need to look at that behavior, and maybe certain people need to be drawn into other behavior. But and I assume there's reinforcements for that, but they need to be reminded of that, I suppose.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what technology holds, you know, for
mm-hmm. yeah.
what the next step is. What do you think the next step is going to be?
Beyond the Internet of Things that I was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to put the genie back in the bottle. I think that computers will become more powerful, more widely used, and everyone will have not only the computers, but computers will be built into objects, and we can, like, interact. You can have, like, maybe a Facebook for your appliances and set it up so they all talk to each other and control that aspect of things, that aspect of your life. Again, I assume it will like I say, magnify pre-existing behavior. But having said that, I see behavior now that I wouldn't have predicted 30 years ago, like say, all these people on Facebook and socializing that way. No one foresaw that. When the camera phone came out, I thought it was silly. You know, why would anyone want a phone in their camera? Well, they did. Virtually everyone did, it looks like. And now that's gone beyond that. You have a little computer.
Your video and your
video
camera.
Yeah, video camera, and just about, you know, you can, your whole world can be in there, basically.
Right.
So I wish I had an answer, you know. I'd be worth a lot of money if I did.
Right.
So.
Well, it's interesting. I think I have a theory that we're going toward the materialism in our society is pushing us more and more toward realizing that once that's satiated, the materialism part, that we can go on into a more spiritual direction. You don't get to a point of letting something go until you have it.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah,
a poor man can't give up money.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
You have to have something in order to give it up, or you have to embody it within you in order to give it away. So I think a lot of the industrialized nations are getting to the point where we're going to get beyond materialism, and maybe if we get beyond materialism, we'll also get beyond war. Because if you study war, a lot of it is based on taking what you want from other people because you don't have it.
Yeah, there is that aspect of it, but there's also the aspect of, you know, we don't like what you're saying about us. Let's go stop this.
Oh, know? Yes, that's true.
I think that,
is it worthwhile going to war with people about that?
I
think we went to war with Iraq to get the oil, you know?
Yeah, well, it didn't help us. I mean, have you seen Iraq oil lying around? No. So I think it's more like, you know, he's saying terrible things about us. And the U.S. lately seems to be let itself get pulled into wars on human rights issues, you know, rescue Europe from itself and all this other stuff. I too would like to think that it could eradicate war, but I think it would probably more like change the nature of it and change the reasons for it. I think that it's too easy.
Yeah, it's probably true.
To take that route rather than sit down and settle things. So,
well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. I want to thank you for joining us. Are you still in San Antonio?
Absolutely, yes.
Great. Well, that's a wonderful
beautiful city, except for the drought. No, we're having a drought.
Oh, you're having a drought?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I spent 5 years there and really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Yeah, it's a very pretty city, except in August.
Yeah, anyway, I've been interviewing Lamont Wood. His book, Out of Place in Time and Space, is a wonderful, interesting and funny book. You can get it, I guess, on Amazon or at your local bookstore. Is that right?
Right. Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
I think even Walmart has it.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Lamont, for joining us.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Next week we have David Gahn with Double Helix Water. On the 24th and on the 31st, Dr. Norm Shealy will be back with Energy Medicine, Practical Applications and Scientific Proof. There's no Noetic Science meeting in December. We'll be meeting the third Thursday at 7:30 at the Dunwoody office in January. Anyway, thanks for joining us, Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.